Hello and welcome to Team GP Perspectives, peer-to-peer conversations digging into anything and everything general practice, brought to you by the RCGP. This episode, we are celebrating South Asian Heritage Month by bringing together general practitioners to share their perspectives on being South Asian GPs. We hope you enjoy the conversation.
My name is Dr. Mo Sattar. I'm a GP. Also, South Asian heritage, Pakistani, and I'm absolutely delighted to be joined by colleagues who I'll invite to introduce themselves also. Let's start off with Alia.
My name is Dr. Alia Goyal. I'm a newly qualified GP working in Small Heath in Birmingham. I'm of South Asian Indian heritage, and I'm delighted to be here.
My name is Tuva. I've just qualified as a GP. Likewise, I've been on the faculty board and I'm part of the Junior International Committee of the College. And I'm of Sri Lankan descent. And I'm actually was born and brought up in Sri Lanka until I was 10 when I moved here. So delighted to be here.
Hi, I'm Zerba Khan. I'm a salary GP in the North Midlands. Qualified just over a year ago, but I am the college tutor for the North Midlands for the RCGP. I am also South Asian and of Pakistani descent.
I didn't actually mention which part of South Asia I'm from, and I'm born and bred in the UK, but of Pakistani heritage. The reason that we're probably all here is because we want to celebrate and showcase our contribution to British South Asian Heritage Month. I'll just throw it out to everybody, really. Who wants to start off and just sort of tell us about your journey as a South Asian person into general practice?
So my journey into general practice may seem a little bit unusual compared to most GPs, but I do think it's got a lot of common themes with some of the experiences of other South Asian heritage women trying to balance their cultural and religious identity with a professional identity. So although I completed my degree and everything without any concerns, I did kind of grow up with a cultural expectation to be married by a certain age and an understanding that I'd have the main care responsibility for children. And it can often be the case that South Asian women have career disruption. But because of these and other things, I had a much longer interruption than most and left the NHS for about 15 years. And then there were some barriers to returning, largely fear, to be honest, but again, more religious barriers. Community who kind of shamed me for wanting to go back to work. And it's quite an internal conflict that I find a lot of women in my position have. It's kind of a disconnect, really, between the patriarchal view that women shouldn't be working and yet females should be seen by a female doctor. But I did manage to find my way back to the NHS, thankfully, and I had a really supportive ST2 trainer. And it's quite unique that the GP training director in my area was also of South Asian heritage and also a female, and she was an amazing source of support for me.
I just want to pick up on that, actually. So you're talking a little bit about seeing people of the same heritage or perhaps people that you can relate to. And you mentioned your trainer. And certainly when I think about my training, I have a real affinity to and relationship with both of my trainers, actually. And I'm still very much in touch with them, you know, 10 years down the line in terms of a doctor and you know, coming out of the first five journey as a GP. So that was really important to you, was it, Alia?
It wasn't my ST2 year. My ST3 year was quite difficult, but I think it's important, regardless of what stage of training you are, you have role models and you have people who can kind of understand your journey, because it's very easy to feel alone. I was actually asked last year to be a speaker at the BMA Women in Medicine Conference, where it was actually the first time that I actually realised how much my experience had actually resonated with others and that I wasn't alone. And it's really important to kind of have people around us who give us self-confidence and identity and a belief of what we can actually achieve.
I think I've equally had a quite different journey, I think, into general practice, into the career to begin with. Like I said, I grew up in Sri Lanka, came here, was brought up in a council household, in a single parent household in London. I went from Barts Medical School, having lived in South London, or coming up to the Midlands to do my foundation years. And having done that here, and I chose to stick around actually to do training here because I liked it so much. And, you know, it's a whole different experience compared to London, the Midlands. So that's one of the things that you want to multiply that in terms of both the fact that it retains this cultural diversity as much as it does in London. I think we retain that in the Midlands as well. And the journey into general practice, I think it's got quite a few folds to it. I think some in the fact that I did at once upon a time in my life want to be an orthopedic surgeon until I woke up and realized what that involves and what better choice GP is because of just the vast amount that it offers compared to what a hospital job does in terms of your flexibility, the fact that you still know and do a little of everything and the variety and the patient contact. I think you can't beat that in any other job apart from GP. And of course, the training has always been challenging, and I think it's challenging for everyone. But for some of us, it's more challenging. And I think people of the BAME backgrounds particularly find it challenging. And that, having been the LNC chair and the IT rep and a couple of other roles in my 3 years as a trainee, I've had lots of people come to me. And they always tend to be of BME groups. And you wonder why. Why is it so common that our colleagues of our ethnic backgrounds have all these problems, and yet it's not so common? And is it just that, you know, we're owning up to it and the other people aren't, or is it just more common? So I think there are a lot of barriers for people of BAME or South Asian backgrounds in training, not just in general practice, but in NHS overall. And I think we're past the point of proving it, because we know the data exists. We know that the GMT knows that. Everyone knows that. I think that our college is doing the right things by putting together the task force and getting an action plan together, because I think that's the next step and that's what we need. So that's me really. And I personally have had quite a tough time in training. I'm glad I'm out and training is done. And yeah, I've learned lots from it, and I'm sure I will hopefully help a few more trainees in my time to come.
I'm starting to hear about your experience through training. I just want to pick up on the point that you mentioned a moment ago. You wanted to be an orthopaedic surgeon, but then you swapped over to general practice. What led to that?
So I did an orthopaedic job in F1 and F2, and I saw what the job was. And I'd just done a placement in year five. So I've never done a job as a foundation or as a doctor in general practice. But I knew that's what I wanted, because I think the biggest differences were the fact that in general practice, we treat patients, not, you know, a case, you know, theatre list and whatnot. And I just think that you don't get that rapport. You don't see that person again. You see them once and you sort them out. And that's the attitude is completely different. I think that's what changed for me. And the other thing also, it's as it does for all of my colleagues, I believe, it is the options for portfolio careers and the variety, not just in, you know, patient workload, but in terms of your role that general practice brings. I think that's what attracted me to it. So yeah.
So it's really interesting how I think all three of us have very different journeys, and it'd be interesting to know what Mo's journey is like as well, just to see what range there is. But I mean, would you like to just know about my journey into general practice or right through from medical school?
Either, share what you like.
Okay. I'm brought up in the West. My parents are from Pakistan. We've always had a very kind of traditional, conservative sort of upbringing. Majority of our social networking has been with family, so we never really kind of had friends outside of it. Growing up, it was always I had a lot of white friends. I didn't really have many Asian friends. So I always wanted to have Asian friends. When it came to applying for medicine, again, I didn't really have any role models per se. There was no one, I wouldn't even say a white role model to become a doctor, but it was just something I wanted to do. And I've always been the type of person that if I can't see someone that I can look up to, it sounds a bit strange, but I'd want to be that person for somebody else. So I thought, okay, I don't have that role model. Well, you know, if I try, maybe I could be a role model for somebody else. So, I mean, I wasn't the smartest person. It took a bit of time to get my grades and a lot of hard work. But obviously, once I started medicine, things were a lot better. And I suppose through medical school, I went to Liverpool. And at the time, it was relatively diverse. I had a lot of Asian friends, from different sort of Asian backgrounds. There wasn't many black students in our year group, but I think as the years went on, there were more and more black students. And I had quite a few white friends, but a lot of my white friends didn't really understand why I, for example, wouldn't go out go out at night with them. And it was, you know, because I don't drink, there's things that I don't enjoy about that type of culture, which I might, you know, enjoy about like other cultures. So I did find that was restrictive, but I suppose it never really went against me. I became third year rep, and again, it was because I hadn't really seen someone like myself that was a representative, and I think that was really nice for probably some of my cohort and maybe the cohorts that followed me, because I wasn't like your traditional medic in medical school. Anyway, fast forward into foundation training. And I guess my whole time being a doctor, I've always been very aware that I'm, you know, brought up in the West, but I'm South Asian and I'm female as well. And it's been a combination of, it's been pointed out to me, oh, you're little, you're little, how will you manage that? That's quite a lot of work for you, you know, what do you want out of your life? Is this really the life that you want? Because I wanted to do hospital medicine as well. Thankfully, it was myself that chose that I didn't want to do hospital medicine. It wasn't other people's choice that I didn't do it. And I think I've always been very firm that the decisions I make about my career should be my decisions. They shouldn't be dictated by other people. In general practice, when I started my GP training, I was in the North Midlands. And majority of the trainees in our cohort, again, were white. We had some international graduates, but majority were white as well. So it was... It had its own challenges, because I suppose I could never confide with anyone about maybe my personal issues or the things that I was facing. I sometimes used to try speaking to my trainer, and I'm sure there were bits that they didn't really understand about me and my life and things. And I guess to some extent that's a hindrance. But I suppose because I've been brought up in the West, I think my kind of social awareness and things, that's not really stopped me. I am married with a child, and you know, I live with my in-laws, and my husband and my in-laws have always been very supportive of what I do. So I suppose my journey hasn't been as difficult as maybe Alia's or Thuva's has.
It's interesting because most of you are in the same part of the world. I actually did my training in Croydon. Like Thuva, I wanted to be a surgeon. And I think, you know, our early years really impact on what we want to do. And, you know, I did a hepatobiliary job. And, you know, that's super, super specialist in a tertiary hospital. And I just sort of got fixated on it. And I suppose it was a blessing, really, because after F2, I decided that I was going to apply for a fellow job. And I arrived in London at the Royal London, and it was like one of the best years of my life doing HPB and trauma, and I learned a lot, but then I realized that actually I like the outpatients, and then the rest is history. And I was very blessed on the GP scheme in Croydon, because it was a very diverse population. I felt a sense of real belonging there. My trainer, Dr. Agnello Fernandez, amazing guy, who was very inspirational. And I think, you know, a lot of what he does is what I do now through his mentorship. And it's interesting, when I became a GP, I did a little bit of locuming, but very short, at the same place, a fixed term locum, and then I became a salaried, and I went to a very affluent area of Yorkshire, and moved back to Yorkshire. One of the reasons that I moved back to Yorkshire was because my hometown, my mum wanted me home. So there's all those things, isn't there, around, you know, South Asian expectation that, you know, you're going to be close to your family, and there's a responsibility. And I still live with mum and dad. And so there's all that element. And the first job that I did was in a very affluent area, and I just didn't belong. I just didn't really, I don't know. I mean, I think it wasn't until I left that I realized that perhaps I did make some kind of contribution to that community. But then moving into Woodhouse, where I work now, and I'm a GP partner, I've never looked back. You know, it's got pockets of deprivation, and then our PCN is sort of is in the fifth out of sixth most deprived areas in Leeds, and it's an amazing cocktail of communities. And often I do a lot of my consultations in my mother tongue, in Punjabi. You know, it's not great, but they teach me, and I think, oh, what's the word for that? And then they sort of fill it in, and it's fantastic. And, you know, it's a great privilege working in the community that I do. You know, I go to the mosque, and I see some of my patients go to the gym. I might go to the supermarket. So I kind of live in the community, and I work in the community, and it's a real privilege. And I think it's really important. You know, we've all talked about role models, haven't we? And I think for me, it's really important to sit in that GP chair, and for another child to come in to see me and actually see an Asian GP and think, yeah, I belong there as well, and I can achieve that. And that's really, really important. Let's move the conversation on a bit. And I'm certainly really, really enjoying hearing about everyone's journey, and there's some real parallels, isn't there? I suppose South Asian History Month, I don't know if many of you, well, you must have heard something about it, but I don't know if you're able to share sort of how you first found out about what South Asian Heritage Month is, because actually it is its inaugural year. It's its pilot, of course, this year, and sort of officially launched. A lot of backing, lots of people joining the party, if you like. But how did you all hear about it, and what does it really mean to you?
So I was actually quite excited and interested when I heard about South Asian Heritage Month, because I think we don't often get an opportunity to kind of pause and reflect on our shared history. I mean, even so far in this conversation, I think we've already demonstrated that we've got a lot of shared experiences, and we can really learn through our telling our stories and by reading about each other as well. I think that unfortunately with the recent COVID thing, it's really shone a light on, you know, the efforts of South Asian heritage doctors, because unfortunately a lot of us have been affected with what's been happening with the coronavirus pandemic. I mean, I learned about South Asian history actually from my grandparents, whom I used to visit as a child, and I used to sit with my grandfather while he used to cook mangoes and guavas, and he used to tell me all these stories about essentially the British Raj in India, and he kept all these journals about it, and I used to love to read those journals. I mean, even now it actually makes me feel quite emotional thinking about all the events and all the thoughts he had about them, because his perspective isn't really what, it's not this romanticized view that you hear about here, as if, you know, that's if you hear it at all. You know, there's a lot of bloodshed. It was really, really hard. My mum was born actually a couple of years before partition. So she was born in 1945, and partition was in 1947. And she came here with my dad, and she didn't really notice kind of racism initially. But with this Enoch Powell's River of Blood speech, the racism that they experienced, it just increased so much. And my parents are actually both doctors. and they used to live in hospital accommodation. And once my mum came, she was telling me she came out of the hospital flat where they lived and someone had spray painted on her car, like, you know, MF. And to feel so vulnerable in a strange country when you're trying to make a difference, you know, it's just really, really, I just don't know how they did it. And connecting with what you just said, Mo, about this sense of belonging, I can completely understand that because I actually trained in a very affluent area in South Birmingham, but it just didn't reflect the population I wanted to work in. And so now I'm actually working in one of the most deprived areas of Birmingham, in Small Heath. It's got majority South Asian population. And, you know, although it's very, very challenging and it can be quite emotionally draining, I do think that our shared culture helps us to connect and validate our patients' concerns and experiences. And it just helps to know that they're not alone either.
That's really powerful, actually. And thank you for sharing that. I know that there's lots of people that went through similar experiences as your parents. And I recently set up the Leeds BAME Primary Care Network. And that actually, you know, lots of things have led to that. But, you know, we're still experiencing racism or other racism or microaggression or whatever you want to call it, even now. So, you know, although something has changed, not enough, I would say. Zeva, how did you first find out about South Asian Heritage Month?
I think it was through the BAME PC Leaders Group, actually. I think we were having some discussions in there, and that's when I heard about it first. But equally, I can relate to Alia in being a first-generation migrant. I was born in Sri Lanka, brought up there, and fled the civil war in Sri Lanka to arrive in this country at the age of 10 with myself and my mother. If you look at the history behind it and you study the history to its roots of the civil uproar, it does go back to, again, colonial times. Not to say there's something to blame. I think it's something to learn from. I think we do have to think about it. And equally, again, arriving in this country at the age of 10, starting, second term of primary school with being unable to speak English, essentially, and trying to sit sat and things. It was an interesting journey in South London. You know, there's plenty of racism to go around, calling names. You know, you can imagine a kid who can hardly speak English in the primary school. And working my way up from there, it was tough. It was tough, to say the least. And people aren't generally supportive either. You know, I remember I went from that school to another state school, and I got into a grammar school for my A-levels. And they were obviously, in grammar schools, you get this treadmill of career support, isn't it? Everything's provided for you. And they were just vetting us for the thing, and they were like, yeah, we're thinking of doing medicine. I was like, they were like, no chance. You haven't got no A-stars, mate. You can say bye. And I would, you know. But then I've always taken an approach that's what makes me want to make that happen, because I want to prove that person wrong. And you know, I'm here today as a qualified GP, and it was the same through medical school. Well, actually, it wasn't so much in the medical school. I went to Barts University of London, is where I trained next to that. So it's that Barts is obviously 50% ethnic minority, so it's a well diverse cohort of students. But even then, if you look at the faculty, you'd be shocked at the proportion of the faculty compared to the students. It's not that equal. And you'd think, in an area that's that diverse, in a student cohort that's that diverse, how come the faculty isn't that diverse? And so I wouldn't say there were no issues at medical school. I'd say it was still a prevalent issue at medical school in all sorts of manners. I did throughout, I think we've had a good diverse sort of doctors in terms of, aside from Dudley.
Just to interrupt there. So do you think that South Asian History Month, Heritage Month, is an important milestone? What does it mean to you? So you talk very eloquently about your experiences and your observations. Perhaps a playing field that's not equal. What do you think this initiative does for you?
I think for me, it does what it does for the Black History Month. It's recognition, isn't it? Knowing that it's a problem is the first step in changing anything. And I don't think we recognize it as a problem, because you know, if you compare us to ethnic minorities, some of our ethnic minorities are a huge proportion, but not many of us. For example, the Sri Lankans are a very small proportion compared in the workforce. So as a whole, I think making a stance and recognizing that, you know, South Asians do have these barriers and putting it out there and recognizing that in the form of the South Asian Heritage Month, I think it's vital and the first important step in tackling the problem.
So that's quite interesting, because I guess we all interpret initiatives in different ways, but your sort of interpretation of the month is more around a campaign against injustice, perhaps. Whereas I don't know if anyone else relates to this, but for me, it represents more of a celebration, and more around, although there is probably some activism and that's probably going to grow out of that, more around, we are South Asian and this is our heritage, this is our history, this is our contribution, this is our food, this is our language, this is our arts, these are our books, this is our literature, this is our music. So it's quite interesting that we've all taken something different from the initiative.
So I think just like you're saying, I heard about South Asian Heritage Month on Instagram, because I'm connected with a lot of South Asian people from different kind of professions, so psychologists, writers, and things, and they were obviously starting to advertise it. But for me, again, from what kind of that community is connecting or associating South Asian Heritage Month with, is more, I think, you know, we've been here since, you know, the colonial times now. We've been here since, people from our communities have been here since the partition, and we're so integrated kind of on a ground level. And, you know, British people, wasn't there something in the news once about chicken tikka being one of the favourite meals of Great Britain? So, you know, that there is a lot of South Asian-ness inside of Britain, and actually just to stop and celebrate it, I think it just highlights, you know, we should be celebrating diversity, we should be celebrating the differences in Britain, because Britain's not the same Britain it was 50 years ago. I know some people would like it to be the same Britain as it was 50 years ago, but it's not, and it's not going to go back to that either. It can't, because we're all integrated into the society now. So I think it's really nice to look back and reflect, and also celebrate what we are and where we've come from.
Alia?
Yeah, I was actually going to agree, because if someone else was to think of the words South Asian Heritage Month, even within a country such as India, there's it's so diverse. There's numerous languages, there's numerous cultures, even religions and food. I mean, we are all kind of communities within communities, and we bring such a richness, both to, you know, to this country and to celebrate that, but also to educate that, because as Zerva said, there are so many ways that we've actually influenced British culture just by our presence, chicken tikka masala being a perfect example of that.
We've all sort of obviously been touched by COVID-19, and, you know, we've seen the statistics and we're learning every day about the impact, and I'm sure that it's going to continue for years to come. And, you know, today, A-level results day, and, you know, even that's COVID's affected results for A-level, you know. It's just been an absolutely extraordinary time. But I suppose, you know, this discussion would be nothing without just quickly touching on your thoughts around that. And I suppose COVID-19 has shown a spotlight on the huge disparity in the way that that it's affected the BIM communities. I'd say it's nothing new. We knew about that a long time ago. But I don't know if I think it's only right that that we talk about it for a moment and just sort of reflect on that. And I don't know how you feel about that.
I do think that, as you quite rightly say, we do know about these health inequalities that exist, and as you say, COVID has just shown that, because our communities have been affected so much. You know, I've reflected on this quite significantly in trading. I'm sure you've heard of things like the Marmot Review, and you know, even things like access affected by language barriers, and you know, even training, I saw the stereotyping of South Asian women in particular as, you know, as heart sink patients whose suffering is all in their head. And the thing is, it does concern me because you know, if this is what we experience in training, then how are we to educate our colleagues as well to know better and to do better? Now I'm working in a really deprived area, and you know, even unpicking, you know, why so many South Asian origin children from deprived areas go to A&E, why are our health outcomes poorer? As a South Asian heritage doctor, I can't help but connect to the pain of my patients. You know, they don't just see me as their doctor, they see me as their ally, and I can help validate their pain and their distress. And, you know, I think it's a very easy thing to say that, you know, health inequalities exist. And as you say, quite rightly, we've got all the data. So what are we doing about it? It's different age groups as well. Like, for example, we have all our multi-generational carers. I mean, Mo, you mentioned, you know, living with your parents, and, you know, Zerva's mentioned living in a multi-generational household. And it all kind of feeds into, you know, not just the problems of COVID with regards to how we go about our, you know, our daily lives, either in our homes or in our communities, but also about, you know, how we protect our communities as well, because there are many things that we as doctors feel we have no control over, such as all this social inequality, housing, the fact that our often South Asian heritage patients are often in low paid jobs, and all these things, they feed into exacerbating the health inequalities that exist. In my area, one of the biggest problems in the GP surgeries is actually GP retention. So a lot of the doctors, they come into these areas to work with brilliant intentions, but then it just all seems too much, and we just need to make it easier for doctors to want to stay in these areas, because it's important to have good doctors doing their best for our patients too.
So I just want to pick up on a few points there. Like everyone, I'm in touch with lots of people on social media, and one of those people is a GP frequently on BBC Breakfast, and she's a Pakistani lady who talks a lot about women's health, in particular how it affects South Asian women, and talks about how, you know, she sees some women, South Asian, who have no other way of describing their perimenopausal symptoms or their menopausal symptoms than pain all over. And actually, you know, they've seen numerous other people, but actually no one's picked that up. And then when she has, she's treated it and actually they've got better. And another report that I saw quite recently around this was that actually an Asian woman is five times more likely not to have her pain controlled. And there's something about that, isn't there? And I think, I don't know, actually, I, the more I think about it, the more it kind of like I have a sense of even more responsibility for the community that we're serving. I don't know if anyone else connects with this, but you know, the fact that I can speak someone else's language, and the fact that I understand, and the fact that I can relate, I feel like I need to do even more. And that's quite and to make it better, it's quite a responsibility, isn't it?
I mean, I did listen to a King's Fund podcast. It was Professor David Williams. And he actually said a sentence that really struck with me, which is, we identify with the suffering of our own group. And I thought that that was actually quite profound, because we do it without thinking. But the responsibility is huge, and it's not just for us to shoulder. And that's one of the reasons why I'm really grateful for opportunities like that, because even if we can make people think a little bit differently, then we've done some good.
I think I'd relate to that. And I think there's a few more things to unpick here as well, in terms of, I think there's hardly any attention or focus on health systems across the world, because one of the common things I find speaking to patients about, especially of pain backgrounds, is about pain control and the perception of, doctor, I don't want to be on tablets all my life, and trying to get that across to them, you know, to get them to agree that, you know, this might actually be helpful. And because for them, they sometimes are used to or want a one-stop solution. And I think for some doctors, it's hard to build that rapport. And for us, I think it's easier for us to do that, like you say, because we're, you know, they can relate to us. They just feel more comfortable with us in talking about these things, and they respond more to our advice, I feel. And I think that there's two things that we have to focus there, not just, I think, being there for them, but in terms of educating them as well. I think there must be a better focus there, both our colleagues and the patients.
It's interesting what everyone has touched on. I echo what's already been discussed. I think it, like Alia said, it takes for someone to kind of relate to their own. And I think equally for South Asian people, perhaps because they've always felt like they've never been taken seriously. Actually, when someone sits down and talks to them about their problems and how they feel and how it's affecting them, and they actually understand what you're saying, it can make a huge difference. My brief experience with some South Asian patients is that I think, for example, living in a multi-generational household, the kind of pressures that might be faced by kind of South Asian professionals or, females, men from South Asian households, try to explain that to a white doctor that, for example, your mother-in-law has a problem with you going to work. That's a big source of your depression. And actually, how are you going to deal with that? Because you somehow have to get your marriage to survive. And also, you want to do what you enjoy. Those things aren't necessarily unpicked unless it's from someone from that background who might be able to actually, divulge into that with confidence. So I definitely think that there is a part to play. But it is huge responsibility, and I don't think all South Asian doctors want to commit to that either, because it might not be something that they want to do, and that's a shame, because I feel like those communities will always stay neglected because of that, just purely because of that. I mean, I was having a chat with a few psychologists, and what they were telling me was, for example, mental health. And mental health is a huge problem in every community, regardless of ethnicity, race, religion, and one of the biggest barriers to people of any kind of BAME background, but okay, if I speak specifically about South Asians, is that they just don't have that relatability with psychologists on the other side. So even if they did engage, either they'd be known as crazy, or if they did engage, the person on the other side wouldn't understand what they're going through and the pressures. And it's part of it because it's not actually in their curriculum to be able to understand these diverse issues. Which has meant that there's like a cluster of psychologists that have basically gone and subspecialized in that. So it's almost like our people from our own communities, if they find initiative and they find benefit in it, they're the ones that are taking the lead on things like this, but it's not being recognized. It's not being necessarily supported on a bigger platform. And I think that's where the problem is there's people that want to help, but if you've not got the backing from behind, you've not got the funding, you've not got the training, the mentorship, it's difficult.
But does anyone have a personal experience around being BAME and perhaps that's put you at disadvantage?
So not particularly disadvantaged. I had an experience. We were doing the COVID risk assessments, and I was speaking to a senior partner We were going through it, and then obviously, you know, being a man and of Asian ethnicity, that puts you at medium low risk. And then we were just happened to be talking about it, and she made a comment, and I was quite surprised by that. And it did take me back quite a bit, although, you know, I've experienced it all my life, and I was like, I'm at this stage in my life, and someone who's senior as this still thinks that the reason that we're more affected by COVID is because of our low socioeconomic status and our poor education. And that's the only thing they can say to defend that. And that was a shocker to me. That was my most recent experience. And it's still vivid, still vivid.
Certainly over the last few months and weeks, like interacting with all sorts of people, networks, organizations, and individuals. You know, one of the things that struck me is the silence that actually often it takes a lot of courage for people to even start talking about some of these issues. And I think, you know, we really do have a problem.
That is most definitely a problem, and it's within South Asian Heritage Doctors, you know, there's obviously a lot of diversity within that. I can only speak to my own experience, which is not only being Asian but also a female and wearing a scarf. Most Muslim women, they do find a struggle to get their voices heard in society as well as in the professional field, and It's a real struggle to be taken seriously. I've even had to push back against, you know, male Asian GPs who've actually asked me why I wasn't at home looking after my kids, and I'm supposed to be there in a professional sphere as an equal, and so it's really difficult to know how to respond to that because there's a huge cultural burden. Cultural guilt burden, should I say. So we don't feel good enough as doctors, and we certainly don't feel good enough as carers, or as people. But I do think that the way people have organised themselves following the death of George Floyd has actually helped to kind of help people to kind of question the current situation and hopefully make positive changes towards making things better for everybody. For South Asian women GPs especially, we're more likely to be working fewer sessions or in sessional or locum roles. We're less likely to be partners, and so we don't necessarily get invited to give our opinions. So we really appreciate a forum such as this because it's really important that everyone's voices are heard.
Yeah, I'm not really sure what else to add, to be honest. I agree with what's already been said. I think a lot more could be done. I wish people weren't so afraid to talk about it, because there are a lot of people that if they did actually speak about it, it might make a bigger difference. So I was speaking to a white doctor on social media, white male doctor, and some of the things that I talk about on social media are very much kind of linked to BAME, linked to health problems and things. And he made a mention of how he really found some of those posts insightful. And I said to him, because then he said, you know, I find them insightful and I completely support you, but I wish I could just talk about it. And I was like, well, you do realize that if you spoke about it, it would speak volumes, more volumes, because it's coming from a white person. I know it sounds ridiculous, but that's the way sort of part of it is here, that, you know, if a white person says the same thing as a brown person, a white person's more likely to get listened to. And it shouldn't be like that, and I don't want to believe that that's the case for everything, but there are some things about race in particular, and if you have more people from other communities and other diverse other backgrounds kind of standing up for minorities, actually you might have kind of more allyship in that way.
It's complex, isn't it? And I think you know, we're fairly young, I think we've got a long way to go, and I'm sure that we'll keep trying to push the boundaries and think, and I tweeted quite recently that that there was a congresswoman and something that she said, and she what she said was that if you don't have a seat at the table, take a folding chair. And I thought that was quite interesting, actually. One thing that does trouble me, actually, is people are so afraid now, you know, like, what is okay to say and what isn't. I mean, you know, and it's really difficult to navigate that, isn't it? I mean, I am often really worried about, is that okay to say now, or is that not okay to say? It's really difficult to know. And I'm certainly, you know, at an organizational level, when we were setting up our primary care network, you know, there was a discussion around, well, is it okay to call it a BAME, B-A-M-E, primary care network? And it's like, is BAME okay or not? And it's so difficult, isn't it? Because, you know, if you take that, just that term, that abbreviation, you know, some people are offended by it. But, like, who sets the bar? Who says this is okay and this isn't? I don't know. And actually, I think what we risk is an empathy gap, where actually we lose people. But I don't know. It's really difficult, isn't it? I don't know if anyone relates to that at all.
It's difficult, isn't it? Because even when Black Lives Matter came out, you know, when the movement started, then obviously a lot of people didn't understand it, and there'd be the reverse, which was All Lives Matter. When actually the black kind of our black brothers and sisters just wanted allyship for their issues to be recognised and, you know, time given for their voice. And I think all, you know, ethnic minorities, I'm not the biggest fan of the word minority, because I know minority means that there's just less of us, but it doesn't mean we're any less than anyone else who's not a minority. But I think all ethnic minorities have a voice. But yeah, using kind of politically correct language is really difficult. And like you say, one thing might offend someone, you know, but perhaps it's okay for them to say it and it's not okay for someone else to say it. And I think it's just everyone should be mindful of their intention behind what they're trying to say. And I think if your intention is clear, that might make it easier for the other person to understand or relate. I'm not sure what others think.
I think regardless of the label that you attach to people, what really matters is the action that those people are achieving. One thing that I have been quite impressed with recently is how people are, particularly South Asian heritage women, are actually starting to actually put themselves forward. For example, the latest example I can think of is for our CGP Council. These phenomenal self-started women who may not have actually thought that they were the kind of person to do that kind of thing. It's really, really quite brave. On a systems level, you know, if the systems for South Asian patients and GPs are designed by people who are outside of our community, they're not going to meet the needs of our community. So we also have to take a responsibility, I feel, to put ourselves forward as well, because we can't be passive and complaining. We need to be active and proactive. For me personally, I have much older children now, suffering from A-level results day to day as well myself. And, you know, I've got an abundance of time and I've got an abundance of energy, but the opportunities, particularly paid opportunities, aren't really there. And again, I find this actually taps into my South Asian heritage. A lot of women were so used to doing things without recognition, without reward. And I feel that, you know, we do things because we care, but I think we need to attach a value to the things that we do, more paid roles rather than just volunteer roles or being asked to be part of things but not getting the recognition that we deserve. It's just exacerbating ethnicity and gender pay gaps, really. But I am positive and I am very hopeful for the future, because I have seen a shift
And I really am grateful to the conversations of the RCGP, and hopefully these kind of conversations will move forward with regards to how the curriculum gets developed, and how we can move our training forward so that people do have positive experiences, even in the future.
Just adding to that, I think you're spot on with what you're saying in terms of where do you draw the line? When are you saying the right amount? When are you shouting too much that you actually become a nuisance to somebody? I've come across that sometimes. Sometimes I feel that sometimes it's hard to draw that line. And what frustrates even more is when you're trying to make a point and the rebuttal is we'll put on some training. And I don't know how much that's going to... It's a difficult place to be. But then there's the opposite as well. I remember once a couple of years back, there was positive discrimination in terms of politicians as well, within a couple of parties and things like that. I know a couple of my Caucasian friends who were very upset about it and very frustrated by it as well. It's hard to set the line in terms of what you can say, what you can do, what actions can happen. But I think until we're doing enough that it becomes a prominent problem, we're clearly not doing enough.
I want to focus on progress. I don't know if you can share as, real GPs, as members of the community, as people from South Asian community, some of the progress that you've seen, and what you think is next for South Asians in the UK.
I think to follow on from the discussions we've had today, I think I agree with Alia in that there has been a shift generally for people from all kind of ethnic groups. But in specific for South Asians, I would like to see in the future more relatable people in kind of as role models for ourselves and also for the generations that come after us. And like Alia said, I think, many of us will have to take that initiative and to take those roles, because we can't wait for someone else to do it, because we don't know when someone else will come, and we either wait for someone else to do it or we just try and get there ourselves. I'd like to see more of that, because I think that will automatically mean that changes will happen. But we all know change takes a long time. It can take years, it can take decades, and before there's any change. But as long as there is some movement, I think that's all I can hope for anyway.
I would like to see the RCGP curriculum reflect a more multicultural primary care, particularly for things such as a CSA exam. I do think it's weighted towards a Caucasian middle-class patient. It doesn't actually reflect the experience that I'm currently having in a really deprived Asian part of Birmingham. And it doesn't, for example, it doesn't give me the skills or the knowledge to understand how to deal with, for example, an interpreter as well. I think it's really, when I was in training, I actually went out of my way to find opportunities. I went to a perinatal mental health conference for South Asian patients. I've learned all about Asian dermatology presentations during my dermatology job, but it shouldn't actually have to be like that. We need more varied training practices, and especially in deprived areas with increasing complexity, because for us working in the West Midlands, it's such a fundamental part of the skill set that we need that unless we actively search out for those training practices, it's not going to happen, because those training practices by definition, they're going to have the worst premises, they're going to have the worst income. We need adequate support for those practices to be able to bring our trainees into them and to teach them those skills. One of the practices I left in my ST3 year, because I moved around a lot, was literally because it was such a niche practice population. So I didn't actually see chronic disease, I didn't see children, and I didn't see women in the perinatal period. And for me personally, that wasn't the learning experience that I wanted, so I left. And I think it's important to kind of think, just because a practice has been a practice for so long, what experience has this given us? Is this doctor going to come out equipped to work in another place? Because if not, they will start working there and they'll just leave because it'll just be too challenging for them. So I think there's a lot still to be done. But essentially, it's just dialogue, isn't it? And finding out what people feel they need and then hopefully making plans to achieve that.
I think equally, I relate to what Zerva said, you know, from year three when, you know, Prof Kumar was telling me of her tales of being a gastroenterologist on a male Caucasian sort of environment to what we're seeing today, and, you know, with Nikki in charge of primary care and, you know, the chief exec of NHS Digital, you know, being a Caucasian male, and with so many CCG chairs being Caucasian males. I think that gives me hope. And the fact that this message has finally got through to the college, to the council, and, you know, there's now an action plan in place, I think that gives me hope. I think that's progress. I think that's definitely progress worth celebrating this month. So I think we're definitely on the way. It's just there's a lot of work to be done, and I think we all have our roles to play in it.
And of course, you're referring to the BAME action plan that's come out of many discussions and meetings and a lot of contribution from across the UK. And we finally got to a stage where there's an action plan and there's a call to action, and there's a request from our college, one of the biggest medical colleges in the UK, a membership organisation. It's in their interest to represent and progress with this plan, I think. And so, yeah, I think we should celebrate that, shouldn't we? And I suppose BAME communities, I think my observation, living in Leeds, you know, lots of family in Bradford, is that, you know, we're a resilient people. We went through a period in Bradford where there was no city centre. It'd been bulldozed down and it was a hole in the ground. Now it's a nice, shiny shopping centre. But regardless, the communities still thrived. And, you know, you need to just drive down the infamous Leeds Road and you'll see, you know, the colour and the diversity, you know, from dessert shops, which I know are not good, and that's a different topic. But, you know, you've got dessert shops, you've got, if you want fabric, you can get every colour and every type of fabric you want. You can go to the fruit and veg shop and you've got a huge array of choices. You've got, and it's mango season at the moment, of course, you know, so and then you've got, you know, some of the really massive names now that have come from, and I'm going to be really biased and say from Bradford, but, you know, equally Birmingham has produced many, many big brands, as well as London and other places. But, you know, we're you know, and many products, you know, especially food, I can think of, you can get in many high street supermarkets now, and I think that's progress, isn't it? That's real progress, you know, real business. You know, there is a presence, we're everywhere, and it's really nice to see. And we're a resilient people, and I think that we should celebrate that. And I think we should also celebrate our real diversity, our music, our languages, our books, and our real heritage for years to come. I think, you know, what was progress was seeing the celebration at the Central College, actually 30 Euston Square, 2 to 3 years ago, where they actually celebrated the contribution of South Asian GPs to general practice, which was really lovely to see. And I think we need more of that. You know, maybe a portrait of a South Asian doctor in 30 Euston Square or something like that, perhaps, would be really, really nice to see. So we've been really fascinated, I think, hearing some of the views and some of the thoughts that people have had and shared today. And I'm really grateful that we've been able to take some time out to do that, certainly to Mark, which is something that's very dear to all of us, which is our heritage, you know, celebrating so that people can listen and reflect, and perhaps, you know, some of the things that we've said people can relate to and find a little bit of strength in and actually call to action.
I just wanted to say, again, I'm really grateful for the opportunity, and I'm really glad that you mentioned that event in Euston Square a few years ago, because I thought that was really impressive. And again, it's kind of emotional for me because, as I've said, my parents are both medical, and the generation that it was celebrating is actually my parents' generation. And on the subject of role models, very briefly, I think Professor Myla Carney was phenomenal as a role model, making people of South Asian heritage feel that actually there is a place for us. And I know he's done a lot of work for health inequalities, and I was really grateful for his president's listening exercise a few years ago, which was when I first met him, because there are people out there trying to make a difference, and we will get there.
I don't really have very much else to add apart from thank you for inviting me to talk as well. I think if we all get our voices heard in some way, shape or form, we'll either, like you say, provide strength to people that are listening or actually educate other people about things that they probably should know about. So yeah, work in progress, but positivity, and we'll get there.
Huge thanks to all of our speakers today. To find out more about their work and access links to the resources mentioned in the conversation, check out the show notes below the episode. If you're a South Asian GP, what would you share from your experience? Why not tweet us at Team GP and let us know? Thanks for listening. Until next time, goodbye.